Good afternoon. You're listening to Unusual Sources on 93.3 CFMU FM. Now, we're very pleased to have with us today a very special guest, Mike Whitney. And many of you may be familiar with Mike Whitney. He's a freelance writer who lives in Washington State. He writes on political issues, civil liberties, and economic issues. And he writes for a number of well-known publications, Counterpunch, Dissident Voice, Information Clearinghouse, Global Research, among others. And of course, Mr. Whitney is notable for having foreseen the severity of the economic crisis facing the United States today. He's been forecasting an economic meltdown. He called the housing bubble collapse for what it was long before the corporate media discussed it. And in 2005, he predicted an uncontrolled fiscal crisis as America's future under George Bush. So, Mr. Whitney, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I guess the first thing on everyone's minds is the drop in the stock market today. We've seen some very shocking and jarring things that has resonated throughout North America, the world, and throughout the media. And I was just wondering, could you begin by giving us your perspective on that?
Well, first of all, I think what maybe your listeners are wondering about is why the Treasury Secretary and the Federal Reserve announced a $700 billion rescue plan, what people are calling the bailout. And immediately after, the Dow Jones plunged roughly 600, 700 points. The next day, on Monday, it plunged another 800 points at one point, and then it returned to about 350 down. And then today, of course, it plunged another 550, roughly, I think it was 580 by the end of the day. So how is it that they come across with this rescue plan, and the reaction from the market, the market has basically voted by now that they don't think that this is going to address the problems. And they're right, because although the banks are carrying all these mortgage-backed securities and this debt on their balance sheets, and so many of them are insolvent, actually, the large parts of the banking system are insolvent now or underwater, and those banks have to be removed from the system, and the banks that can be saved should be saved. But because the banking system, the buying of those assets does not directly address the problem. The problem is in the credit markets. And what is happening is that commercial paper, which is the kind of notes that it provides the grease, the lubricant, that keeps industry and business and banking and everything, keeps credit moving through the system, that part of the system is frozen. And as long as it remains frozen, that's why the Fed made interrupt or went beyond its traditional powers today and said that it was actually going to provide resources up to what some people are saying between $900 billion and $1 trillion. And this is beyond the $700 billion that are going to mortgage-backed assets to provide the wherewithal to loosen up the system so that credit can flow through the industry so the whole thing doesn't shut down. And that's what we have right now is the system. We're not just talking about stocks losing value or asset deflation. You're talking about the whole system is shutting down in front of our eyes. And this is this is a very serious, very dire situation, and there's only a few people who have any kind of ideas of how to remedy this because it's very involved. It involves getting money to leasing companies and different financial organizations to produce this commercial paper, the banks, the large corporations, so that these people can begin rolling over their debt again, so they can meet payroll, so they can cover their inventory, so they can do all the routine things that keep commerce going. Sometimes it's these little things, these incidentals that you and I don't know about that are the nuts and bolts of our modern industrial system. And if this isn't addressed immediately, which is what the Federal Reserve is doing. Now, what the Federal Reserve did today, as well as prospectively or possibly a coordinated interest rate cut in the next few days with the other G7 countries, which is, will produce more low-interest money to possibly lubricate the system or provide more liquidity for the system. These are things that can actually have a positive effect. That doesn't mean the stock market is not going to keep going down. it will keep going down, not necessarily in a straight line, but at least these things are remedies. What we saw last week with Henry Paulson's $700 billion, which is basically just a bailout for his friends, did nothing, and investors know that, and they voted with their feet.
While we're on the subject, let's talk a bit about that bailout. You say it's bailing out a few people, friends, investors. So this money's coming out of the American taxpayers' pocket, I imagine.
Exactly.
So it's not bailing out people that have mortgages or people that are facing losing their homes.
No, it does not help the homeowner at all. Basically, what it does, and the Secretary of the Treasury is not required. There's some provisions for oversight, but they're very weak, and they're not going to be administered at all. As a matter of fact, he has already appointed Neil Kashkari, a 35-year-old Goldman Sachs vice president, he is going to be overseeing the distribution of the money. Then we're going to have private contractors, I think 12 or 13 asset managers, who are also all going to come from private industry. This is not going to have the corporate oversight or the government oversight that I would like to see. Distributing this money, now we don't know if that's just going to be plums to friends of Henry Paulson, or even what they're going to be buying. Are they going to be buying mortgage-backed securities? Are they going to be buying these unregulated side bets called credit default swaps, which I think maybe many of your listeners saw discussed on 60 Minutes last weekend? So we're not exactly sure what it is. I am speculating that some of the money may go to buy back some of the GSE debt or the mortgage-backed security debt from China, who's getting increasingly wary about buying our treasuries, which, you know, if they stop buying our debt, then we're basically done, because we consume more than we produce, up to roughly $700 billion a year, so we need people to buy our treasuries. So anyway, we don't exactly know where that money's going to go, but we know it is not going to go into lubricating the system in a way that the credit distribution is going to be such that's going to keep the machinery of industry and trade going, which is what we need to do right now.
Well, even by the standards of what they're trying to do, is this $700 billion going to be enough?
No, it's not. It's just a starting point. But the main thing is that reading the Nobel Prize-winning economists Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman and Nouriel Roubini and any number of economists, there was over 200 economists the next day came out and said, this is not directed at the right area. Like, there's a way. Remember, the IMF and the World Bank have stepped into these situations many times where a banking system in a developing country is failing. And they take different measures. Out of 42 cases, 35 times, they've never purchased the bad assets or the bad debts. That's just not the way you go about doing it. What you do is you provide capital. You provide capital injections to the bank so they can keep operating and keep loaning money to consumers and businesses. And that's essentially how you do it. You buy a preferred stock so that the taxpayers have a share in the company. They have a stake in the company. You just can't go handing out money to the banks. This is a business. The taxpayer is not protected at all in that. And so that's how you get direct injections to the bank. You don't go out there and start buying their crappy assets. It just makes no sense at all. All it does is it's just a favor for his friends, essentially.
I mean, how is this being received? Because it seemed at first that Congress was resisting it, and then they've gone with an adjusted bailout. You mentioned how the reaction among the American public was 50% no and 50% hell no to this bailout. So how did it end up getting put forward in the way that it has been?
Well, there were over the average representative, congressman, senator, what I've read, were getting 200 to 300 calls against for every one call. There was basically no support at all for this bill. And because even from the beginning, the language, they were saying that essentially this is a bailout. Now, and Paulson seemed to, you know, use the language himself. And I think the bailout was a kind description of it, because essentially it's a giveaway. I mean, they're not even bailing them out. They're giving this money away to cover their bad debts. But no, it wasn't popular at all. But the Congress was so afraid that we were going to have a systemic meltdown because there was this there were these problems in the credit markets, which were driving up different gauges, the fear gauge, the TED spread, the LIBOR, all these things that made it look like there's this huge problem. And there was a huge problem, but it wasn't because simply because these banks were holding mortgage-backed securities. It was in the credit markets, and that's still where it is, and that's why the Fed had to step in today with real solutions for the problems we're facing. Is that hard to understand? I mean, it's like they preceded, they knew there were problems in the credit markets. Henry Paulson's a very smart guy. So he went to Congress and got his $700 billion before they addressed the real issue. So they come back next week and get another $1 trillion, which is what it's going to take to loosen up things in the credit markets.
This is costing quite a lot of money. I mean, can they really afford this given the trade deficit, the debt in the United States? Are they printing dollars to make this happen?
Well, yes, we know they're printing dollars because the Fed's balance sheet is around $900 billion. And the last month, they spent another $500 or $600 billion providing short-term loans to the various banks just to keep them operating. Like I said, a lot of these banks are technically insolvent, but they are, it's like dead man walking. They're propping them up next to the water cooler and making them appear like they move their arms and legs every so often so they look like they're alive.
Weekend at
actually,
Bernie's, is that?
What's
like
that?
Weekend at Bernie's.
Yeah, at Bernie's. So, I mean, that's essentially what it is. They need to go in, and this would be a massive operation. They need to put the bad banks right down their debts and put them out of their misery. It's going to mean a lot of consolidation, which is not necessarily a good thing. But that's the only way that they can call out the bad and prop up the good ones, because the whole, you know, all of the apples are getting infected by the contagion from the bad ones. And the fear is prevalent everywhere, which is making people afraid to loan between the various banks. Now, I know some of this stuff sounds complicated, but, you know, anyone who's interested really should look into this a little bit. This is not only a confusing issue, but if you don't learn it now, you're going to learn in the future, because this has huge implications. We are going for quite a sled ride for the next 5 or 6 years because we have all been defrauded out of trillions of dollars by what the investment banks have done in creating this enormous amount of credit that isn't backed by sufficient amount of capital. And now that bubble is unwinding, and the real economy, as we saw today, the consumer spending is down. People are going into the hunker down mode. They either are maxed out on their credit cards and their car loans and their student loans and their mortgages, or they just sense, like you were saying about, what was it, MSN.com, that had that poll that said that over 50% of the people believe it's likely that we're headed into a depression. So 9 out of 10 people think that the country is going in the wrong direction. And every time the market takes a header like it did today, Obama's stock goes up dramatically. Obama is lurching ahead in the polls now because anything related to the economy, you know, of course, you know, Bush is hung around McCain's neck like a millstone. So I don't think that's something he can dodge.
Well,
but I guess I'm getting off topic here.
Well, there's a lot of interesting things in U.S. politics. It's finally made the economy an issue. I just wanted to take a moment to ask how you think we got to the situation, because after all, you have been talking about this for several years now. Before the housing bubble collapsed, you talked about how the housing bubble was going to collapse. Now we're talking about securities and debts and bank issues. So what do you think is most at fault, or who's to blame? How big is this crisis?
It all begins and ends with the Federal Reserve, and this is generally agreed on both the right and left side of the aisle now. I mean, we hear, you know, whether it's in the Weekly Standard or the Wall Street Journal, the flagship, you know, right-wing newspapers, most of the blame, it goes to the Federal Reserve and Alan Greenspan and his low-interest monetary policies following the dot-com, where he actually kept interest rates at or around 1% for 33 months in a row. So when you are essentially, if I'm selling you a dollar for 90 cents, you're going to want to buy a lot of those, right? Now, that's what the Federal Reserve does, because when inflation is running at 5 or 6% and you're selling dollars or credit at 1%, you're losing money. And so what happens is that's how they attract people, speculators, to borrowing a lot of money. Now, they knew who was borrowing it. In the late 1990s, it was all going into the tech bubble, and it could, you know, everyone knew that that thing was going to blow. This time around, like I said earlier, the retail value of real estate in the United States went from roughly 10 to 11 trillion to 22 trillion in a six-year period. So it doubled. The Federal Reserve knew where that money was going and knew the prices were entirely artificial and that they were propped up by not just their low interest, but also by the availability of credit. So that's why anyone who could fog a mirror, whether they had a job, whether they had any collateral, whether they could manage a down payment, or whether they had bad credit, could go in and borrow $400,000. Well, of course, if you're living through stagnant wages and you have no other opportunities to get ahead, and everyone else is making money in real estate and telling you, hey, what do we all hear? You never lost money in real estate. You know, of course you're going to flood the market.
So
this is where all that phony prosperity came from. But I was reading the stuff in The Economist, and the New York Times had a pretty good coverage of it, surprisingly. But it just wasn't mainstreamed. Everyone was saying this is the new economy, and we're never going to go downhill again. And, of course, it was only a matter of time before people finally couldn't meet their obligations, before the adjusted rate mortgages set in and the whole thing just unwound.
So the housing bubble was part of a general situation of very abundant credit.
Exactly.
You had mentioned China. Where does the rest of the world come into this? Obviously, the U.S. needs other countries supporting it in various ways. How are they doing that, or a better question, why?
Well, you know, at one time, our regulated markets, our strong capital markets, the most prosperous, the most stable, rule of law, democracy, I mean, they were very attractive. And when we deregulated currency flows so that people could move their money into our capital markets quite easily, buy our treasuries, buy our investments, they literally essentially ran out of investments for people to put their money in. This is why they created this attractive... You see, the model of mortgage-backed securities actually came from Fannie and Freddie, and it's a workable model. It's all that, you know, very few people default on their loans, on their mortgages, if you make sure that the regular criteria for loaning money is maintained. So, in other words, if someone has a down payment, if someone has decent credit, if someone has a job, if someone has some collateral, if all those things are, then a mortgage-backed security is not a bad thing. You know, people can make a certain higher level of interest rate on it. It provides a revenue stream. When Wall Street got it, what they did, and by 2004, 2005, Wall Street was producing money for between 75 to 80% of all the mortgages in the United States. So they didn't care if the loan was made to people who were going to pay back or not. Why? Because they were going to sell it to, various retirement funds or insurance companies or foreign banks or the Chinese or the Saudis or something like that. They were packaging this stuff. It was garbage. It was fraudulent. They knew it was, and they thought they'd get out of Dodge before the whole thing blew up. They called it distribution of risk. It wasn't at all. When you're selling a house to someone who you know cannot pay that loan back, that is fraud. And that's what was happening. They were packaging these things. They were making tremendous fees. Everyone was getting rich. And they frankly didn't care. And tons of leverage was stacked on top of those because not only was it the debt itself, the mortgage. Okay, imagine this for a minute. You got a $400,000 mortgage. that, you know, is really never going to pay off. So that's 4,000 because the guy has no job, he has, you know, bad credit, et cetera, et cetera. And then you stack all this additional, in other words, by the time this gets to a hedge fund, they're using that $4,000, reporting it as an asset. It's actually someone's debt. They're reporting it as an asset and borrowing 10, 20, 30 times the value of that asset on that mortgage that's never going to be paid off to begin with. So that gives you some idea of the magnitude of the bubble that is unwinding right now. And it doesn't matter how much money or credit the Fed produces right now, the market is still going to deflate. Jobs are still going to be lost. And there's just going to be a general credit contraction through the whole system that hopefully does not create a general sense of paralysis in the system. But it's going to be quite dramatic.
You've studied the situation for a while, and you're able to take a long-term view. How do you see things shaping up from here? As you mentioned, there's a lot of fear of extended recessions, of depressions. Things are going to get worse. So how long do you think it'll be before this bottoms out? Or do you think there may be efforts towards re-regulation? I mean, what's going to happen in the future?
Well, yeah, that's certainly in the distance. The reason I say that is there's going to be a deep recession / depression, no matter how you cut it, as this bubble, as these trillions of dollars deflate from the system. Because once you wring that out of the system, it's actually a very simple model. If there's less money in the system moving at a slower speed, then there's less business transactions. If there's less business activity, there's less growth. And so you can just, you know, by rule of thumb, you can say that if the velocity and the amount of money that's being circulated slow down, you're going to have essentially negative growth. We're going to have that no matter how you slice it. That's not what we're facing right now. The biggest concern right now is that the whole system is going to seize up. And this is a very dicey situation, and we're right in the thicket. And I think there's only a few people in the country, as a matter of fact, Nouriel Roubini, the economist who has basically used his crystal ball to foresee everything that has happened to this point. He was named Dr. Doom by the people on the smiley TV pundits and by the New York Times, etc. But now he has become very widely regarded for his projections. And he was interviewed the other day in an emergency session of the Council on Foreign Relations. And he not only gave his prognosis, but he gave his solutions, one of which was to provide emergency aid for the commercial paper market, a huge amount of money. I mean, I think that the Federal Reserve is actually providing somewhere in the neighborhood, like I said before, of $900 billion to $1 trillion to get this thing unfrozen. And no one knows if it's going to work. And he also said that there's $4 trillion in deposits in American banks. There's $6.5 trillion. But $2.5 trillion of that are not insured. So what's happening is there's a run on the banks right now as we speak. Because the people who are not insured or above the limit of $100,000 are taking their money out and putting it into other accounts or putting it someplace where it's insured because everyone is getting afraid. So he has suggested that we insure all of the accounts to whatever amount, which is now they've moved it up to $250,000, which covers most people in the recent bill. This is another really important thing because the deposits in the bank are the cheapest capital that the banks have. So if they don't have access to that, if there's a run on those banks, then they can't loan and the whole system goes into reverse. So it's another really dangerous part of it. So, I mean, he has made basically the suggestions that now the Federal Reserve and the Treasury are operating. He's basically, I mean, if anyone gets a Nobel Prize, I think it's going to be this guy this year because he has created the blueprint for saving capitalism, essentially. Now, whatever your feelings may be about that, if they don't act quickly and pursue a blueprint like this, we ain't going to make it. We're not talking about a depression. We're talking about just the whole thing seizing. It's that dire.
This is obviously very frightening, and more so because you have been more accurate than the smiley TV commentators, as you put it. This is certainly a very expansive picture you've painted for us on this issue, so I thank you very much for that. And certainly we can continue to get your coverage of this issue by going to Counterpunch and Dissident Voice. You'll be giving us upcoming articles on this crisis, I imagine. Is there anywhere else that we should tune into to get more of your writings?
No, I mean, you can always find me at Counterpunch or Information Clearinghouse, Dissident Voice. And I think I'm going to try and have an update on this tomorrow and try to make it, it's so difficult to understand this, that try to make it seem a little more palatable, because I find it very difficult. I'm not an economist by trade, and so sometimes I try to break down the difficult language so that, because this is really something everyone should understand. It's going to affect their life quite dramatically.
And certainly, I think some of the way that these structured investment vehicles were set up intentionally to be difficult to understand. So it's always good to have someone clearing it out for us.
Exactly.
I want to thank you very much for coming with us on the program today, then, Michael.
Thank you for having me.